Jim, anybody like to make some comments on issue two? I'm here. Oh, Andrew.
Okay, thank you. I think this maybe links back a bit to the discussion that we've been having for the past while, because I think that the focus really comes back to the basic principle of who is delivering and who is facilitating. And I think that my view, when just jumping back into the control point, is if control's not obvious, then the indicators are there to help you work out what people are actually doing. And that comes back to what's in the contracts of what people are providing to each other. So when I get onto issue two, the focus for me is very much on, am I providing this or am I facilitating someone else in providing it? That would then probably for issue two take me either to view A or conceivably D. I don't think that if someone else can sell something for their price and you have no idea what that price is and you've got no interest in that price, how does it concern you? And how has it got anything to do with the contract that you've got with your customer? If I go back to the simple example of the restaurant, there was a note from our US colleagues that there seemed to be two contracts, and I think that that is in fact key to it. Because the restaurant has got a contract with the intermediary. That contract is for the intermediary to introduce customers. There's then a second contract between the restaurant and its customer, where the restaurant sells the good, in this case the meal, to the customer. And that then pushes you in the direction of who's facilitating the transaction, which is the intermediary, in this case Costco, and who's actually providing the service, in this case the restaurant. And that for me pushes me into working out whether someone's going to have a net amount of revenue or whether someone's going to have a gross amount.
Yeah, and so what would your answer be in the restaurant?
On the restaurant, it feels to me like there is a net facilitation fee going to Costco, and then there's whatever the restaurant gets for the meal. In this case, I think some people have said $70. If that's what they get, that's what they get.
And so if the intermediary sells it for 90, they've got revenue of 20. So
what you that would seem to be the implication, yeah.
Any other, Tony? It comes back to, if you think about it from the perspective of the intermediary, it's who is the intermediary's customer in that circumstance. Because if the intermediary is providing a service on behalf of the restaurant, that implies that it's acting on behalf of the restaurant to procure people to walk through the front door, which might imply the restaurant ought to be accounting for that gross with a fee knocked off. But in fact, if what the intermediary is doing with the fee recorded as an expense. But if the intermediary is providing something, selling a right effectively to the customer, then that might suggest that the accounting would be net in the books of the yeah. So I think it's very much dependent on identifying the customer in that situation.
Any further comments?
Similarly, to the previous question, I was saying that the key is what's the nature of the promise. And I think if the originator has absolutely no idea what the end user is actually paying, that's almost certainly telling me something about the nature of the promise that the originator's making. So there's quite a good chance, I think, that I would get to view A in that case. But I think that that information is still only informing my decision. So in a way, I have a gating question that might either take me to view A or might just conceivably, in a fact pattern I can't quite imagine, leave me with an open question. Mm-hmm. And then if I have that open question, I think I may have a different category of question. It's actually quite a practical question about what kind of information I'm going to put in the financial statements if I really don't know how much the person I believe to be my end customer is paying me.
But are you saying that, well, today you haven't really seen an example whereby, you know, having really analysed it carefully, you've concluded that the intermediary is really an agent, but you have, you know, you've got this problem about having no visibility into what the sort of end revenue amount is and what the commission is?
I'm not sure if I'd dealt with this question personally before seeing the paper. In the 2 weeks since I've had the paper, I haven't identified the fact pattern. But given that my answer to the first question was all about indicators and making a judgment, I feel in the interest of consistency, I need to leave open the possibility that I might get somewhere else in fact pattern. I don't have it at my fingertips.
Mary.
Ian, when thinking about the steakhouse example, which I think is helpful for me because it's an intangible, the card, the right, backed up by a tangible, one thing that strikes me is if somebody took view A in terms of Morton's obligation, performance obligation, is to transfer the good or service to the intermediary, in this example Costco, not to the end customer, does that imply to people that Morton's would recognize revenue for that transaction when it delivered the card, even if that delivery, having placed blank but not authorized cards at Costco, let's say they become authorized the moment Costco sells them on, would Morton's recognize the revenue when that card was delivered on, when Brian walked in and bought a card at Costco, or would we expect them, Morton's, to wait until it had actually delivered the meal to recognize the revenue? And just thinking about, you know, the further implications of view A and view B with respect to timing rather than amount, and, you know, if you think through it that way, does that impact your, you know, your choice or your assessment of both the nature of the promise and who is the customer?
So you're saying in those circumstances view A wouldn't make any sense?
Well, I guess I'm saying if we're so, you know, if we have we focused down so narrowly in thinking about this and maybe got a bit caught up in some of the mechanics. I think Mark's example of Morton's in the steakhouse being a little more tangible than the pure gaming, the pure intangible scenario, makes me think if you take view A, Morton's performance obligation is transfer the good or service, which is the gift card, to the intermediary, which was Costco, not to the end customer, which is Brian. Presumably, when you fulfill your performance obligation, delivering the card, you recognize the revenue. And would that make sense at the time that the card itself is delivered to Brian, if that's the performance obligation?
I have to say, I don't get to eat out that much, so I may be a bit more up on the gaming fact patterns. But I wonder, in answer to your question, I assume that in these fact patterns, the restaurant actually has an obligation to serve the customer who's purchased the card. So it comes back to what's the nature of the promise. On the one hand, to transfer the right, but also to honour the right, whoever happens to be holding it at the point in time.
And that would be an obligation to the intermediary as well, I think, to honour the obligation the intermediary sells on would be a performance obligation.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would bring it forward.
It's a general principle that revenue recognition for granting of rights occurs when you grant the right and not when the receiver of the right starts to make use of the right. Mm-hmm. So if I see that voucher as a right to go and have a meal, like a piece of software with the right to use the software, I would recognize it when the right is granted, mm-hmm. and the receiver can take the right and go and have the dinner, mm-hmm. not really at the time when the receiver decides to have the dinner.
So
other consideration, of course, if I fear that it may be returned, and I need to give the money back, that's a different consideration. But if I've granted someone the right to come to my restaurant and have a dinner, why is that different to other rights that I grant, where I usually recognize the revenue upon granting the right rather than upon when the right is leveraged by the receiver of the right?
I have to, I was going to make the, in response to Mary's question, I think I would see that the restaurant, if it has sold a right, would have a promise in its contract with the intermediary to honour that right when the customer walks into the restaurant. And I think the guidance in the standard would say that you would recognise that as a performance obligation. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't bring the revenue forward.
And so you don't think that helps you in terms of looking at, is it view A, view B, view C? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. No further comments. Back to you, Jim.
So I think, Daryl, did you have the signal for two hands up?
Yeah, I wanted to get in on Mary's question because I think she brings up an interesting observation. The thing that I would say, though, is that I think most of these arrangements would be such that, in our example, Costco would not pay for that card until they sold it to their customer. And so, therefore, the fact that Morton's delivered the card to Costco, yeah, maybe they've, you know, satisfied their obligation to deliver that card, but I think they'd have trouble passing the collectability threshold at that point because Costco is probably not going to pay for that card unless and until they sell it to their customer. So, I mean, those cards could be thrown away, they would be useless, et cetera. So, I think it would be hard to expect a recognition of revenue by Morton's at that point.
Marty.
Yeah, thanks. I thought what Mark Siegel said a lot earlier was very important, and that was maybe the fundamental aspect of the standard says start with the contract, and as opposed to who is the customer. And it seems that, to your point, if there's a contract between Morton's and Costco, and they have sold that card to Costco, then that's one contract, and Morton's would defer its revenue until it ultimately had the meal delivered. But on the other hand, Costco would recognize its revenue when it sold the card to the customer. So there's a couple of contracts there. There's a contract between Morton's and Costco, and later on there's a contract between Costco and the customer. And then Morton's fulfills its performance obligation when the customer comes in and recognizes its revenue. So I think, you know, from an auditor's perspective, looking at the contract, if you change the terms where, well, they're not going to pay Morton's the cash until they sell it to a customer, then there's a different contractual arrangement, which affects, again, the timing of the arrangement. My only point being, it seems like trying to figure out customer and things like that before you figure out, analyze the contract, seems to be the starting point of your standard and the most compelling issue here. What is the contract at each point along the chain here?
Allison?
Just building off of a question that Mary was asking about the timing of revenue recognition, this question about, you know, if the originator of the transaction, if the restaurant is selling through its gift card, and if the promise in that obligation is to transfer the gift card, and we're saying that that's the performance obligation, does that drive the timing? I think that question does exist, even in looking at the example that's included in the standard for airlines, example 47, right? In that example, the conclusion is that the performance obligation is the right to fly, not the actual flying of the airplane. And so, as I've understood this example, the intermediary purchases the tickets ahead of time and arguably takes on the inventory risk, and that seems to be determinative. And so if we're saying that in that situation that the intermediary is the one that's responsible for fulfilling the performance obligation, that the performance obligation from the airline is to sell it to the intermediary, and that the intermediary there then their responsibility is to sell it on to the end customer, I think that might suggest that, you know, the logical conclusion might say, well, then the airline should be recognizing revenue at the time that they sell the ticket to the airline broker, the airline intermediary here in this fact pattern, but in practice, I don't think that's what happens. I think that the airline recognizes revenue when they fly the plane, regardless of who it is they're selling the tickets to, but yet in example 47, where you've reached the conclusion that in some instances, the intermediary can recognize the revenue for the tickets because their underlying obligation isn't flying the plane, it's providing somebody a right to fly. And this goes back to my question of, well, what are we trying to define? What is the underlying promise that we're trying to sort of target in terms of revenue recognition?
The promise for the airline. Sorry, for the intermediary. So
again, but what is the promise that we're accounting for?
But we're two different parties, though. The airline has a different promise than the intermediary, so the intermediary's accounting can be different than the airline's. So what I'm trying to figure out is why does the fact that the intermediary could get revenue when they sell it leads one to believe that the airline should get revenue when they sell the ticket to the intermediary?
Well, I'm not saying that they should. I'm just saying that that's just, I think that was, if I've understood Mary's question correctly, she was trying to figure out whether there was some sort of interconnection between the conclusion about gross versus net and how that influences the timing of revenue recognition for the originator in the transaction.
Tom?
I thought it was about the customer, as you suggested, but I'm beginning to agree with the gentleman in London, at least in thinking about it, what Marty says. It's thinking about the contract as a whole and identifying what the promise really is and to whom and at what price. We've been talking about Morton's and Costco and suggesting perhaps that the contract between Morton's is with the end customer to deliver the meal. But if that and that Costco might be an agent to identify a customer for that. But if we were to think about what the gross revenue would be then, it would be more than 70. Because somehow if Costco's an agent, there has to be some agent price in there. The $70 ends up being a net price because what happens in the economics of that transaction is the agent fee is the difference between the 70 that Costco paid Morton's and what they receive, if that's the agency price. And if you were thinking about it, would not a gross revenue be somewhat more than 70, less the commission you pay an agent? If that was just an agency, and if that's not the case, then is the promise really to the end customer, or is the promise, if you think about the promise to whom and at what price, is the promise to Costco to deliver meals to peep the customers they identify, and therefore Costco is then reselling, and they would be principal. Just open questions, but I think the view about identifying the promise to whom and what price allows us to think better about what the control and indicators are related to. Just an observation. Mark.
Yeah, this is Mark. I think Tony hit on it over there. I think the obligation that, and it's the gift card examples, just easy to understand because I'm probably older and don't understand these virtual goods too well, but it could apply the same as if you sell a bag of fake coins that you can then go build buildings with, I guess, online or whatever my kids do. But the coins themselves, and it gets into what Mary was talking about, are we selling the coins and the right to go use those coins on my hosted website to build bigger buildings or to buy cows or fake cows or whatever you do online? Or, is it the coins themselves? And we've always looked at it, like Allison said, that the obligation is, and in my case, I would say, it's an obligation to the intermediary. If I'm the hoster, that I'm going to honor whichever one of their customers come in. It's my obligation to the intermediary. So that's why we would look at it as, that's the customer relationship. It's the intermediary, in this case, the Costco. It's the obligation, if I'm a steakhouse, to honor whatever customer of Costco comes in, I'm going to honor that gift card on behalf of my obligation to Costco, not necessarily my obligation to the ultimate customer.
I think it's not dissimilar from sort of what Marty said as well, thinking about what is the contract and what is the promise is certainly the way that I have to think of these things. When people use the term virtual goods, it actually annoys me because I don't know what that means. In some cases, I think what people are doing is selling software. In other cases, I think what people are selling is gift cards. So coin, this is just how I look at it. Coins, or as Mark described them, fake coins on the internet that I can use to purchase software or I can use to purchase other things, I have a hard time distinguishing why that's any different than if I called that a gift card that had a nominal value on it, or a notional value on it, rather. So I think, at least in part for me, it's helpful to think about what is the promise and who is the promise to. Larry.
But if you use what I believe was Marty's suggestion as to the thought process, I think it would automatically lead you to recognizing, let's say, Costco has to pay $70, $70 on Morton's side, and I think it would, I think the rationale would be that you would recognize revenue gross at the intermediary level, at least that's the way I thought of it. And I guess one question that I had is, it doesn't seem like these transact, the gift card, the Costco Morton situation, is all that different than selling consignment inventory, which I think would lead you to answering the intermediary question that you would get, you would record that at whatever you get. And I guess one question in my mind is, and I don't know if this should influence your decision, would Costco or could Costco ever sell that gift card for less than the amount that it's required to pass on to Costco?
I could come in with a Costco-issued coupon.
Okay.
And get the gift card for $20 off because I had a coupon.
And therefore, even though they don't really have the inventory risk, which is not all that different than consignment inventory, might that be an indicator that we should look to for purposes of answering the intermediary question?
That gets back to some people were saying to look at the economics. Who controls the economics?
In the consignment inventory example, though, would you say, though, at some point the retailer, let's say, actually does have control, maybe only for, you know, the minute that it takes Jim to check out? So there is a clear point where you do take control of this physical good and then you pass it along versus, you know,
while I understand that thought process, Colin, I think it to think about instantaneous control, I don't think is all that helpful in answering the question. I think what would be more helpful is it within your authority as the intermediary to generate a profit or generate a loss? And in those, you know, if the answer to that is you can do either, then perhaps that leads you to a conclusion that the intermediary should be accounting for this, you know, as an inventoryable item, despite the fact that they don't have inventory risk per se.
That may lead you to gross accounting at Costco for the gift cards, because it's very likely they have the ability to sell those for whatever price they can.
I mean, gross being defined as what? At Costco,
yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, because they may be able to sell that for whatever price they can.
Whatever the case, I want to come to a conclusion that says that Morton's doesn't have to guess what their revenue is.
I can get to that conclusion without putting at risk some other things. What you just said about if the intermediary's got pricing risk, that tells me and I'm going to call out a company's name, not because I'm focused on that company, but because everybody's heard of it, Groupon would be gross. And that was a very high-profile situation where they moved to net after significant discussion, because Groupon can, if they wish, make their offers to users and give the user an incentive. Say, hey, you haven't bought a Groupon in a while. You can buy your next one for half off. And that's not going to change what Groupon has to remit to the restaurant, store, or whatever it is. So I think we run the risk, which we always do in these kind of situations, of talking through things in such detail and at such level that we identify problems that hadn't previously been thought of as problems. For example, today, Morton's does not recognize the revenue from the sale of a gift card until somebody comes and gets the meal. There is no question. There may be a question as to amount on the gross versus net, but we started talking about the when. I think Morton sells to Costco a promise to provide a meal to whoever presents a gift card. The promise is clear. And so Morton's has revenue when the gift card is presented or when there's breakage. That, I mean, I think the timing is clear. I agree with you completely, Larry, on the amount that Morton's should recognize. Morton's has agreed to provide a meal for $70. That's their revenue.
And Larry, to your point about whether the cards held by the intermediary are an inventoriable item, I believe that in most cases, they don't even recognize necessarily that they have these cards. I mean, the plastic cards are worth 2 or 3 cents. They can be thrown away, lost, whatever. They are not worth hardly anything until they're activated at that register. And so I think it would be hard for them to think about them as being something of value that they would have in inventory.
Why wouldn't you think of it as having the right to sell a meal that cost you 70? It's not the card at 3 cents. The inventory is you've been given the right to sell a meal, an intangible right at this point. And I think you have the price risk in that, because if you're going to pay 70 for it and you can sell it for anything else, I think there's some price, at least the margin that you have at risk.
But Tom, you can't have a risk if you don't sell it. If you don't sell it, there is no risk, which is, I think, where Daryl's heading is. The card is just a vehicle to convey at a point in time in which it sells that card. That's when the product is created, if you will. There is no product until there's a transaction.
That depends on whether Costco pays for the cards ahead of time or at the
true
time of identifying the customer.
Now
we're back to the intermediary.
One question I have is,
you, the grocery store, when did you pay for the cards?
That was my point earlier, was that I probably would not pay the restaurant for the cards until the customer buys the card from me.
Right, right. So if that's the case, even if it was inventory, what would be your journal entry?
But isn't the real question in that situation whether the store, the Costco, Daryl probably knows this from his background, do they recognize it gross or net when they actually sell the card? And I think that's the question. You know, I go to the grocery store, there's a wall of gift cards I could buy. I go to the grocery store and I buy a $25 gift card at Target. Okay, and I pay the grocery store $25. The grocery store probably pays Target $23. Does the grocery store recognize $2 in revenue or $25 in revenue and $23 in costs? My guess is, under the current literature and how they would think they would do it under the new, they recognize $2. Is that right, Daryl? I think you would know that from your
background. I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're off of issue two and back to the intermediary question now. But I think that's a big deal.
But, Scott, if that's a commission, then does the restaurant recognize gross revenue of
$72
and a commission of $2?
No, the grocery store is working for the end customer, not for Target.
Scott had a warning or caution earlier. I actually think we're creating issues that don't exist in practice today, potentially. But Sue, and then on to issue three.
One of the questions that I had, we've had a lot of discussion about the intermediary and so forth, but I know Rita, as a user and investor, I wondered if you had a perspective, particularly with respect to the intermediary on some of these situations, as to whether what information is more valuable to an investor.
It really does, in my mind, depend on how the contract is written. And to the point on Costco, I think it is more of a commission. But that's specific to that type of good in that period. The confusion from an investor point of view is that you can take the same two originators and the same two intermediaries and have some be commission and other be principal, and when they're reported to an investor, they're commingled. So you know, that is part of the problem.
Mary, do you mind teeing up the third issue for us again?
The third issue was, how should the transaction price allocation guidance be applied to a transaction in which the entity is a principal for some of the deliverables and an agent for others?
Ian, it looks like we don't have any comments on the third issue here.
Do we have any comments? Yes.
What was discussed, I think the example of Morton and Costco was very interesting, but I'm not so familiar about those companies, so maybe for the next example that you give, if you could explain a little bit who those companies are, could be useful. The second thing I wanted to say is, here we are talking, my understanding is that there are already today, with existing guidance, examples that are difficult to deal with, and I understand that IFRS 15 is not going to help. However, there are many cases, especially for goods, where agent versus principal is very useful today. And our understanding was that the guidance is not going to change with the new standard. So, especially for what I'm talking about intermediaries, which are distributors. We are using the current guidance of agent versus principal, and our understanding is that it's the same indicators that have been using in IFRS 15, and we don't expect differences in the analysis. However, and this is an implementation issue for preparers, we are still going to do the analysis of the agents versus principal transactions that we have had in the past, because we consider that a new standard on revenue will be the opportunity to make sure that we deal with those indicators in with homogeneity. We might in the past have done several analyses, but not at the same time, or we might also have acquired companies where we didn't do the analysis. We just took for granted the analysis that they had performed. So even though we don't expect differences, we are ready to do an analysis agent versus principal to make sure that this is applied consistently within or in our company.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? No. Question three is not bringing on along a lot of comment. Maybe it's because we've been going nearly 2 hours.
I think we have Scott Tobbs got his flag up here, Ian.
Well, I'll be short. I mean, my sense is that this is not as concerning to people, because I think in most arrangements where this is the case, the answer kind of falls out from the way the contracts work. I mean, for example, consider an entity that provides technology solutions, and so they buy equipment and resell it, and then they also do a bunch of services to get that equipment installed and up and running. So they're, you know, they've got a gross situation on some of the equipment and a net situation on other equipment, depending upon whether they just arrange for it to be shipped straight there or hold it in inventory themselves ahead of time. And the pricing arrangements are usually so clear that, you know, on the equipment that they're just going to order and have drop shipped and perhaps would be net on, the arrangement with the customer is just kind of a cost plus. You're going to pay the cost of that equipment, and then you're going to pay our fee. And it is the our fee portion that is negotiable. And so you wind up, I think, in a situation where nobody really questions where the discount goes. It's just obvious from the pricing. So my sense is that this question doesn't necessarily really get thought of all that much, because people just look at the pricing in the contract, and that's the way it goes. And I think that would probably in most cases put you in the situation where you meet the criteria to allocate the discount entirely to one of the elements.
Okay.
and people don't really think about it as a discount even.
So if I'm hearing right, it seems like, at least as potential issues, there's greater challenge in applying the judgments in the first two. For those that are listening or paying attention, the objective was not to necessarily provide any guidance or resolve issues. So if you walk away saying you're sort of dissatisfied with the end result of that discussion, it's really to inform the boards of whether there is an issue to take on. We appreciate, I think, that there is judgment, but is that judgment within in a bound that people know how to make the decisions that they need to? And that's the follow-up that the boards will have after this meeting. And I think that the discussion has been useful in providing us input to have those subsequent discussions. We're about 5 minutes behind on the first issue. So with that, I think if people are okay, and Ian, is your sense that folks are comfortable in London moving on to issue the second broad issue?
Yeah, that's fine, Jim.
Okay. Which, by the way, won't move on from the topic of gross versus net, by the way. Mary also has this issue.
I've just got James would like to make a comment.
I'm just not quite clear. What's the feedback that then comes from the board post this in terms of, I mean, those were quite inconclusive discussions. What's the feedback that then comes back from that in terms of what happens from here when the board then reviews, say, points one and two?
I think we now will have to reflect on what we've heard, but as sort of Cullen was explaining with the process, essentially, you know, we will certainly report back at the next meeting. You know, hopefully we can report back about what we intend to do or in response to what we've heard today. Now, there could be situations whereby actually we may not yet have made that decision, but we'll report that back to you and, you know, follow up in due course. But it is obviously very important that there's a clear feedback loop to this group and also obviously to all of the stakeholders.
Thank you. But I think you make an interesting point that it's going to be interesting to write up this discussion.
That's fine.
Okay, sorry, Jim.
Okay, so moving on to the second paper. Some stakeholders have informed the staff that there may be multiple interpretations of the application of the guidance in the new revenue standard in determining whether to present certain items billed to customers as revenue or as a reduction of costs. Some examples include shipping and handling fees, reimbursements of other out-of-pocket expenses, and taxes or other assessments collected from customers and remitted to governmental authorities, for which explicit guidance in U.S. GAAP was superseded by the new revenue standard. Additionally, under existing IFRS, amounts collected on behalf of third parties are excluded from revenue. The guidance on transaction price in the new standard states that the transaction price should exclude amounts collected on behalf of third parties. Sometimes it may not be entirely clear whether or not the amounts are collected on behalf of third parties. In those cases, some stakeholders have expressed a view that the entity should apply the principal agent framework. So the FASB and the ISB would like the members' input on your views about this potential issue, whether you're aware of any other interpretations or any other related interpretation issues related to this topic.
Participants in Norwalk, any discussion on the second paper? Oh, Allison.
This was an interesting discussion that we had both within our U.S. practice and then in talking with colleagues around the world. And maybe it's because there's a U.S. bias towards thinking that certainly shipping and handling and out-of-pocket costs would be recorded as part of revenue consistent with current practice. And so I think there is a bias within the U.S., or at least there's a concern that there would be this bias, that you'd interpret a lot of those gross versus net indicators to point towards gross revenue recognition, at least in the United States, because that's consistent with current practice. Again, with respect to shipping and handling and out-of-pocket costs, with respect to international perspectives, you know, what I'm hearing from my colleagues overseas is that oftentimes maybe some forms of shipping type services might be recognized gross, but oftentimes handling costs, very often if those are internal type costs, that those likely would not be incorporated within revenue under today's practice. And so I think that there might be a bias to approach it, the gross versus net analysis, a different way, thinking through questions about profit margin, et cetera. I think in the United States, consistent with how the EITF reached its conclusions back in 2010, there's a lot of focus on, well, you could price your goods any number of ways to capture shipping costs, and that the fact that you've priced it into your goods versus separated it separately on the invoice, that really shouldn't be a determining factor when reaching the conclusion about gross versus net revenue. So I think that that mindset will continue under US GAAP. So when we've talked about it within our global group, folks overseas are saying, well, hey, wait a minute, if that's the mindset, then there probably is a need for additional guidance here to help make sure that the framework is applied consistently. And then with respect to taxes, I thought it was actually interesting when I read the paper talking about amounts collected on behalf of others. I think most of us have just read that and kind of glossed right over it and said, okay, that's great, taxes are not included within revenue. And so it was interesting that the paper makes a distinction that perhaps there might be some circumstances when you would. And I thought to myself, well, I'm wondering if others would really pick up on that fact that there might be situations when you would include something that people would think of as taxes in that gross revenue line item. And so therefore, if that's something that people would overlook, is that another area where further clarification is needed?
Allison, can you help me understand your point about you were saying outside the U.S. there might be a view that there's difference between a third-party shipping cost versus internal?
Well, I think if a company is performing the shipping services themselves or has discretion in supplier selection or is potentially earning a margin off of that, that there might be a view, even under today's practice under IS 18, okay, that the shipping part is revenue, but any things that might be thought of as handling, and that's not really defined in the literature, but handling costs might be the internal costs that you would incur for the materials for the shipping, for the overhead costs to run a shipping department to pull things together for a customer, that some of those handling type costs might be not thought of as direct costs related to providing the shipping, and so those would be recorded not as part of a revenue generating item, but just recorded purely as an expense.
And I wonder if they think about those questions mostly because they're separated on the invoice, because otherwise it seems hard, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of what the costs are? There's, you know,
right,
potentially thousands of costs that make up the shipment of one product. It just so happens that you've decided to, or you've been able to call out, you know, two of the thousand.
Right, and I guess that as I've understood it from past EITF can work on this particular issue, that it's difficult to decide what is really a shipping cost, what's really a handling cost, and so however you kind of define that you end up recording that as a gross amount of revenue, that you wouldn't end up reflecting any reimbursements of those amounts as a reduction of cost.
Rita?
From the point of view of following e-commerce companies, it seems to me that shipping cost in particular has become a competitive tactic that is not related to their cost of buying shipping services. So larger companies will have a discount, and then any size company is using shipping offers as a promotion. And, you know, it varies by day part, et cetera. The other thing with regard to shipping costs, Amazon has Fulfillment by Amazon, where they charge people on their marketplace for shipping services as well as warehousing, et cetera. It's all bundled in. They're receiving fees for that discreetly. So they're in that case the third party. You would definitely want to be recognizing that shipping.
Scott.
I think I probably read this too simply, but I was applauding the boards for having answered this question in one sentence in the definition of the transaction price. The amount of consideration that the entity expects to be entitled in exchange for transferring promised goods or services to the customer, excluding amounts collected on behalf of third parties. So unless you're collecting the money because the customer owes someone else and you're just passing it through, it's part of revenue. I was done after reading that. I was lamenting the fact that everybody in the U.S. now has to figure out in every jurisdiction whether the sales or excise tax is being levied on the company or the customer, because in EITF 063, we took a pass on that. And this, I thought, made it clear that you got to figure it out.
Got to analyze 50 states.
50 states, 1,000 cities, countries, whatever you got, but you got to figure it out. I thought that made it clear, which, by the way, I think is the right answer. But for everything else, all these shipping and handling costs, everything else that you might pass through or not pass through, it looked to me like it was gross. The only way it wouldn't be was if literally it was the customer that chose and contracted with the shipper, and you just offered to funnel the money through. And I don't know why companies would do that, but I could certainly see situations when they might. That also might be the case if you sell insurance on the goods that you ship. It may well be that the insurance contract is solely between the end customer and the insurer, and the money passes through, but you're collecting on behalf of somebody else. So that would be one where it'd be excluded. But just about everything that I see here, out-of-pocket costs, shipping costs, travel, all that kind of stuff, I actually thought this made it clear that the answer was gross.
Scott, could I just follow up with a question there? Just, I understand this might have been partly as a result of joint drafting, but would you, for example, think it would be easier if the definition of transaction price didn't say, for example, some sales taxes, but instead, in your view, you think that really sales taxes could be without the sum qualifier in front of it?
Well, no, because I think that some things that are labeled sales taxes are literally a tax on the seller, and some are literally a tax on the purchaser. Okay. So I thought some sales taxes was basically telling you, you got to figure out who actually owes the tax.
That was the intent of some.
Well, I got one. Okay. Scott, I'm just reacting to what you said about lamenting the idea of having to go through every jurisdiction where sales tax may be collected, the thousands of jurisdictions. And I recall sitting here as an EITF member when that EITF issue was decided that my recollection, foggy now, is that was more of a practical expedient of it didn't seem to be a problem that needed to be solved, that just disclose what your policy is. And if you do gross up for sales taxes, disclose that amount. And it just kind of seems to be a counterproductive activity to essentially force everybody to go through every single jurisdiction to figure that out, so any given company could have a wide range of whether it's grossed up or not. And I don't recall if there's anything in the new standard relative to disclosure around that, but it doesn't seem to be productive activity. And I'm thinking about the work that auditors will have to do to come to grips with what a company has done. That doesn't seem to be a productive activity either, but yet it seems to be necessary if that's what the conclusion is.
So I think Jay says you got one wrong, Mark. But I
Greg.
I just want to add, really echo Scott's comments. When we took a look at this, we kind of had the same reaction that you did, that it seemed to be fairly simple and straightforward. Now, having said that, we didn't see anything wrong with the guidance kind of points you to use the gross versus net guidance if you're confused about a particular cost, and we thought that might be an appropriate approach to use as well. For those that are not as clear, maybe on the surface.
Ian, over to you.
Okay, thank you. Philippe.
Thanks. Well, I think as a follow-up of Scott's observations, which are very clear and to which I fully concur, it may be helpful when you don't know for a tax, whether it is a tax on the entity or a tax on the customer that is collected by the entity on behalf of the taxation authority, to try to determine what happens when the customer doesn't pay. If the production price isn't paid, is the tax still due by the entity, in which case it seems to me it is a tax on the entity. If the entity can claim a tax deduction or a tax credit because the customer has not paid the transaction price, seems to me that it was a tax on the customer, which is collected by the entity on behalf of the government. So I think it should help in clarifying. Would people agree with that view, or is not other? Is it more complex than what I think?
I don't know, Tony.
A couple of observations. I think the idea of whether or not a company should account gross for shipping and handling or for out-of-pocket expenses, I think I'd be inclined to go back to the model as a whole and say, is there a performance obligation, excuse me, to a customer to provide shipping and handling or some other type of activity? And if there is the nature of the promise to organise the shipping and handling, or is the promise to provide the shipping and handling? And with that in mind, I think, subject to the conversation we had under paper one, my sense would be, let's use the guidance that we have. And I think I'd probably say we don't particularly need any more guidance, that you can work through the model to decide, is there a separate performance obligation? And if there is a performance obligation, what is the nature of the entity's promise? As far as taxes are concerned, I think it is clear that the judgment is around whether or not it's the entity being taxed or the customer being taxed, and in which case the entity is just collecting taxes on behalf of the government from its customers. I probably wouldn't be perhaps as clear-cut as Philippe was. I think that's one of the factors that you would take into account, and I think I'd be inclined to look at the indicators of whether an entity is principal or agent as perhaps being helpful, but because you need to look at a variety of taxes in different parts of the world, I wouldn't necessarily say that they are absolutely definitive or any one indicator is definitive just because of the range of different taxes. Having said that, I think I'd still be in the same place of saying I don't think there's a need for additional guidance in the area. I think you could apply the model. I would say to what Alison said, perhaps that reflects my background of being used to applying the existing model to various types of taxes in the past.
Christophe.
Yeah, maybe to echo what Tony said about shipping and handling, I think it would be very, very difficult to draw the line. So if I send a consultant to the customer and the consulting needs to be performed on premise of the customer, the flight and other travel expense, you would say yes. If it is virtually, what about the leasing cost for the internet and the other facilities through it is provided? So you could go a lot further by what is still a matter of handling, in particular if it's not for physical goods. So I think we wouldn't find an end there, and I don't see a lot of basis in the standard to get to a treatment as expense. It is painful because if you charge it to the customer at cost, it dilutes your margin. I think any other approach, number one, would I think require significant changes to the standard to get there, and I don't think would result in something that would be consistent accounting, because we would fail in defining what is handling. About the taxes, we've had a number of instances in which we struggled in certain jurisdictions, maybe less with official sales taxes, but some countries have levies that are based on revenue. And then it's difficult to determine, because it's sometimes not even very clear in the jurisdiction whether the criteria that Philippe mentioned are met or not met, because the answer may be it depends. And that's why that is something we're struggling with, but I don't see what guidance could be added to ease that struggling. I think that's simply a judgment struggle we've got to go through.
Emmanuel.
About taxes, I have a lot of concern about using the agent versus principal framework. For example, for VAT in Europe, clearly companies are agents. It's a pass-through tax with zero commission, and all flows go through balance sheet and not P&L. So I don't see how it works in that example. And for most taxes, specifically in the pharma industry, we could say that the companies are principal, which means that they should maybe book them as expenses. However, they are linked with programs where governments will reimburse part of the drugs. So agent principal would not help to consider whether they should present it as deduction of sales or as expenses. And even though we were to book them as expenses, so it would be a change probably for some of the taxes that we have today. Under IFRS, we would have to go through IFRIC 21, which means that in some circumstances, we would have to book them the year after, which is not something that American preparers would have to do, because I don't think they're the equivalent. So there, it's really something very sensitive. I don't think that the framework agent principle by analogy is actually working for taxis. And the impacts are very important in terms of presentation and in terms of timing of recognition of the expense.
Perhaps just to reiterate what I believe international practice is at the moment, which is that this is absolutely a case-by-case assessment. In the case of transport and shipping, maybe it's quite often gross, but I've certainly purchased things, going back to the internet, I've purchased things on the internet, and I've been able to select the carrier, and the cost has seemed like a pass-through, so I don't think transport and shipping is necessarily always gross. I would echo some of the complexities that can arise in assessing taxes. When you look around internationally, they are extremely complicated. Some of them are clearly related to sales, some depend on production, some depend on what percentage of what you produce you actually sell. So it is inherently difficult, but internationally, that's not a new issue.
Okay. Thank you. Any other, no other comments? Jim, back to you.
Any other comments here? Mark?
Yeah, thanks. It's Mark Crowley. Just one discussion that we had in our camp when we were talking about this, and I think we agree that with some of the other folks around here, that seems that there's going to be some judgment in... but we generally agree with where this was. But if we conclude under the new model that you're principal in shipping and handling, and you look at the sort of the definition of a good or service, is that a service that now needs to be evaluated under the guidance along with whatever product you're delivering? So it gets into the question. I know there was an example in there, the original ED before, that said shipping and handling was a separate performance obligation. So it just came up in our camp of, we're saying we're principal in the shipping. Does that mean that now we have to evaluate it under step two as a separate deliverable? And does this sort of, you know, how do you deal with today? We would not say shipping is a deliverable in arrangement. If I sell you a hat and ship it to you, you know, for $100, well, that's one deliverable. Does this suddenly, by under the model that is under the new standard, does it suddenly say, well, that makes you the principal in shipping, so therefore you have to evaluate it as a separate performance obligation, and how do you deal with that? It's just something that came up, and I don't know whether anyone has any other thoughts on it, but we didn't come to any conclusion one way or the other. But I didn't think it was meant to change the practice of, if I'm recording it gross and I sell you a hat for $100, I'm going to recognize $100 when I hand it off to UPS. If I'm the principal in that arrangement, do I somehow have to bifurcate that now and say, some of it relates to shipping, and I'm going to defer some of it. Just came up.
In that example, though, if you are the manufacturer and I'm the customer, you make a widget and you ship it to me. If you were to say that the shipping and the product were separate performance obligations, which I'm not saying, but let's say that they were. At the end of the day, the customer just wants the product. So the fact that you've manufactured it and put it on the shelf doesn't necessarily take a step towards fulfilling the performance obligation to me.
Yeah, not on the shelf. When you hand it to the carrier, whoever the carrier is, it's not you. I mean, if it's you, I guess you have to deal with other items, but you hand it to a third-party carrier. Is that, and it gets into the FOB shipping point and FOB destination, and then you get this synthetic FOB destination. So I don't want to get into all that, but it's something that came up by calling it the principal. I think what we do today makes perfect sense, that we you either show gross or if you happen to be net, you disclose which way you do it. I think that'll be the same under this, but just want to make sure that it was clear by calling, you know, saying your principal in that arrangement, because of the way we've defined goods or services in step two, that it would be something you can't ignore, I guess, because inconsequential, perfunctory deliverables can't be ignored.
Ian, last word before we take a break?
In response to Mark's comment, I guess I thought of it around
thinking about whether it was a separate performance obligation, thinking about when control of the goods transfers to the customer. So if the control of the goods transfers when those goods arrive at the customer's premises, so on delivery, it might be difficult to see shipping as being a separate performance obligation because the entity is delivering its own goods. But if on account of moving to a control model, control passes on shipment, then I think at that stage, shipping may well be a separate performance obligation. And that's when it might be necessary to think about whether the entity is arranging for someone to ship or providing the shipping service. So that was the way I'd thought it through.
I think there is a connection between those two things.
Okay, thank you, Jim.